is a News 1130 special report.
We're here with Jeremy Allingham, the author of Major Misconduct, The Human Cost of Fighting in Hockey. It's available from Arsenal Pulp Press. First of all, Jeremy, thanks for doing this.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
So you start by saying hockey is an easy game to love, but there's a dark side that hides in plain sight. In the book, you say you were as big a fan of fighting in hockey as anyone. What changed things for you?
Well, it's funny. You'd think that such a big shift would kind of come through a process, but for me, it was a moment. And it came, I was at a Friday night Vancouver Giants game at the Pacific Coliseum when they were still playing out here in Vancouver. And I was with a few buddies and just enjoying some beers and ready for a good night out at the good old hockey game. And it was one of those fights where the gloves hit the ice before the puck does. And I kind of like had this epiphany moment where as the crowd rose to its feet and kind of had this guttural bloodlust scream and cheered for these guys, I zoned in on their faces and realized that they were just kids, that they were really young guys fight bare knuckle boxing each other on the ice. And after the fight subsided, I turned around to someone sitting near me and grabbed a program. And sure enough, they were 16 and 17 years old. And I don't know exactly why, but in that moment, kind of my gut dropped and I just didn't feel right. And I actually didn't really watch much of the rest of that game. I kind of just went up to the concourse. And ever since then, I've just come to see fighting in hockey as this kind of blemish on a beautiful sport that has speed and skill and thinking and teamwork and vision. But for some reason, we like to stop all that good stuff every once in a while to let two people and sometimes kids at the junior level bare knuckle box each other on the ice.
Now, of course, being anything less than pro fighting in hockey can make you seem downright un-Canadian in some circles. Tell me about that infamous Twitter exchange with Don Cherry.
Yeah, I was just I was in at work early one morning and just kind of floating around Twitter, and I saw that Don Cherry had tweeted something. I think it was like, I was just watching the greatest fights in basketball history. They were slapping each other. And I kind of went, oh, my God. And I rolled my eyes. And I, without thinking, wrote back to Don Cherry, fighting in hockey is a disgrace to Canada and the game, and sent it. And honestly didn't give it a second thought until about 10 minutes later when I checked my mentions. And I had dozens of vitriolic responses. And those ranged from, you know, some standard and not so bad responses, just like, hey man, if you don't like it, don't watch it, which, okay, fair enough. But then there's some pretty brutal sexist, misogynistic remarks, homophobic remarks, name calling, just, you know, basically people saying really brutal things. And it kind of opened my eyes to kind of the vitriol that and the divisive nature of the argument that accompanies this topic. And I think that for me kind of really pointed to the fact that like you said in the first question, like this is a really contentious issue that hides in plain sight. Like when you go to the game, it just happens and there's no second discussion. But I think it's serious enough, and we've seen from the injuries and the fallout that can happen to the players with traumatic brain injuries, with degenerative brain disease, that this is something that needs to be discussed much more in much more detail.
And the major side effect we're talking about is CTE. How would you define it, and what happens to the brain with CTE?
Yeah, so I want to be clear that I'm not a medical health professional, but I've leaned on many experts to write the chapter in my book about this brain disease. And basically what happens is when the brain's just floating there in the brain fluid, and when you receive a concussion or a subconcussive trauma, the brain speeds up in the head and it often hits the inside of the skull. And what happens is it torques and twists and shreds, and that leads to a concussion or some sort of trauma to the brain. And when this happens repeatedly over the course of time, what can happen is there's a buildup of something called tau, which is a brain protein that usually helps with the transmission of neurons. And that tau starts to spread and starts to take over the brain and turn and shuts down some of those neural pathways. And what you get is this degenerative brain disease called chronic traumatic encephalopathy. And that's bad enough. You can kind of envision the imagery that goes with this disease, but the symptoms are really scary too. And the guys in my book live with symptoms common to this disease, and that's depression, anxiety, suicidal ideation, rage, impulse control, an inability to focus. Basically, you can kind of lose a lot of the faculties that you kind of just rely on your, in your day-to-day life, and it can be devastating. And perhaps the cruelest thing of all about CTE is that the science is not there yet to actually diagnose it in living patients. Scientists are working really hard to do that. But right now, the only way you can know if you have CTE is once you're dead. So there's actually no way to know. And then if you think about that, what that means is there's no way to actually have a therapy or a treatment for it, because in order to develop a therapy, you need to have a patient and say, they have this disease, let's see what things make them better. And because we can't know, then we can't develop a therapy. So it's this like mysterious, horrible illness that befalls people, but we don't really know until they're passed away. And we saw it recently, like Stan Mikita, Hockey Hall of Famer. He had CTE, but of course we didn't know until he had passed away.
Do you think enough is being done in the athletic community, not just hockey, because the first time I ever heard of CTE was in pro football, but do you think enough is being done in pro sports to address this issue?
I don't. No, I think it's something that's still swept under the rug. It's something that's kind of pushed away. And I think a lot of people couch it in, well, you know, it just happened to that guy. I don't think it's going to happen to me, or I don't think it's going to happen to my players. And I mean, we saw it this past summer. NHL Commissioner Gary Bettman went before a parliamentary subcommittee on sports-related concussion out in Ottawa. And he actually misrepresented the science before this panel. He had quoted this famous Boston University neuroscientist named Anne McKee. And the next day she came out on Twitter and said, what Mr. Bettman said at that subcommittee is inaccurate. And I'd invite him back to my lab to kind of bring him up to date on what we're actually doing here and what the knowledge is. So, I mean, I don't know if he did that on purpose, of course, but I think if you took it seriously, you would know the science and you wouldn't say the wrong thing to the subcommittee. So, I mean, I don't see them taking this very seriously. I mean, they just settled the lawsuit with the NHL players, not just, but last year for $20,000 a person, which if you look at the lives some of these people lead with this disease, I don't think is quite sufficient for what has happened to them. So I think it's something, and I mean, if you think about it, fighting would be a really easy thing to get rid of in the game to start actually making brain health a priority. And you know, there's small tweaks that can happen to the game that can make the players safer. And I think that all leagues, and especially the NHL and other pro hockey leagues and major junior hockey leagues, need to take into consideration to really put their players first.
Now, do you find opinions on fighting in hockey have evolved over the years or since you've started writing about it?
I seem to think, I would say not too much. I mean, it seems like in the mainstream, it's still really accepted. I was at a game last year. It was the Canucks against the Lightning. And I don't know if you remember this one, but it was this, in the second period, I think there was five fights. Every whistle, there was a skirmish. And I remember local sports media was calling it the Wolfpack game. Everyone was all excited about this game. And I was just blown away. I was seeing the kids watching it. And I was sitting beside this older woman. I think she was probably like 65 or 70 years old. And then in my head, I'm thinking, surely if anyone in this building would say the fights are bad and we shouldn't have them, it would be her. And I started chatting with her, and she said, you know, they got to do what they got to do. If the refs won't call the game, they've got to police the game themselves. And I mean, that shows how pervasive this belief is, and that we fall back on these axioms that, you know, once you investigate them a little bit, don't really make that much sense. Like, the players have to police the game themselves. Like, why? Why don't we have rules that actually keep players safe? Like, why don't we have rules that punish people who put hits to the head or hits from behind or sucker punches or whatever it may be, so that we don't have to have this cumbersome infrastructure of hockey violence, vigilantism that needs to take place? Like, I just think we really need to like critically think about this. And I mean, to answer your question, I would say it's evolved a little bit, but not too much.
Now, fighting, as you've noted in the book, is down in the WHL and across the board. But what do you think it would take to eliminate fighting from hockey completely then?
Yeah, so first I just want to touch on the numbers. It is definitely down, and that's absolutely a good thing. But it's not down. I mean, if you put it into perspective, so I added up the fights between the three major pro leagues in North America and the CHL, the Major Junior National League. And between those six leagues, or those four leagues, pardon me, there were 1,770 fights last year. If you look at that number, that means the sport of hockey is the most epic purveyor of combat sports on the continent and probably in the world. I mean, like, Ultimate Fighting Challenge could not put on 1,770 fights in a year. Like, it just wouldn't be able to do it. So I think, yes, the number's down, but I mean, it has so far to go. Like, there was nearly 2,000 fights last year where people, like, if we saw people fight on a street corner, we'd call the police, but this happens nearly 2,000 times in 1 year on the ice. And now when it comes to getting rid of it, you know, you hear a lot of people say, like, shift the culture. And, like, I think that's a fair point, but I think it's too vague. And I really think it just comes down to legislating fighting out of the game. And what that will require is a courageous administrator, a commissioner, or someone who has some sort of power over the rules to say, you know what, we don't want to have any more Steve Montadors, any more Derek Bugards, Rick Rippins, Wade Belax, these guys who all died, Bob Probert's. And then maybe, you know, maybe they read the book and they say, you know, we don't want any more James McEwen's, Stephen Peets, Dale Pierantons, who guys who just have really tough lives after they play this game and they play it with such force and such violence. And so I think what you need to do is legislate it out. And I'll give you an example. In the Ontario Hockey League, 3 or 4 years ago, they brought in a rule in the off season that was, every time you fight above three fights in a season, so every time a player fights, they get suspended every time they fight after that. And you know what happened? In one off season, from one season to the next, they cut fighting in half. So if you legislate it, if you decide you don't want that anymore and that you value player health over having a few scraps out on the ice, you can do it. You just have to do two things. One is, take away the thing hockey players love most, which is the ability to play hockey, aka suspensions, and add on some fines. And don't just fine the player, fine the teams too. So then the teams and the players have this kind of incentive to not be undertaking that practice. It's really dangerous.
So finding the team would then bring the owners into this as well, and God knows they don't want to lose any money. Is there a role, though, for fans to play in all this to, as you say, to change the culture?
I think so. I mean, I don't know how realistic that is, to be honest, but there's a part in the book that actually wasn't written by me. It's an excerpt from one of the players, James McEwen, former captain of the Kelowna Rockets. And he has this kind of like, it's kind of his manifesto that he writes, and it's addressed to different people. And the one group he addresses is the fans. And he says, I ask you not to cheer for this. I ask you to turn your backs on the fights. And, you know, I think that's a powerful image. And I think it would be amazing if that ever happened. The likelihood of that happening, I'm not so confident in, but I definitely think, man, what an impact that would have if some group of fans really stood up to this practice and said, you know what, we love the game and we love the players who play the game. Let's just see the shooting, the passing, the scoring, the beauty of the game, and let's get rid of this kind of barbaric practice that we, for some reason, cling to.
Because as you write in the book, once fighting is gone, hockey will never be the same, because hockey will be less violent, hockey will be safer, hockey will be better. But you don't sound optimistic that this will happen anytime soon.
You know what? Things can change fast. I mean, like, the reason I wrote the book is I have hope. The reason I wrote the book is that I love the sport, and also that I've been deeply, deeply impacted by knowing these guys, like these three guys in the book. Like, this all started with some journalism I did a couple of years ago, and you just start to uncover these stories and you see the pain that these guys have lived with. And the cruelest part of it is that that pain came from a dream. It came from a dream to play the Canadian game at the highest level, to impress your parents, to impress your teammates, to win championships, to score goals. Like, we love hockey. All those things are beautiful. And like, the pursuit of the game and the passion for the game is something that we want to foster in this country because it's awesome. But to see the result of that being people on the verge of suicide, people with drug addiction, people homeless, in and out of prison, I think that's too much. And so Is it a tough hill to climb? Absolutely. But is it important enough to pursue? And do I have hope for it? Yeah, I do. And I think hockey will be better and it will be safer once we finally get this out. When that happens, who knows? But if we start talking about it and we bring the subject to light, I think it can happen eventually.
All right, I think that's a good place to end it. The name of the book is Major Misconduct, The Human Cost of Fighting in Hockey. My guest today, Jeremy Allingham. Thank you so much for this, Jeremy.
You're welcome. Thanks.
You're listening to News 1130, Vancouver's breaking news, traffic and weather station.